Welcome to Speaking in Maine on Maine Public Radio. I'm Sam Tracy. Today is the second part of our four-part series from the 37th Annual Camden Conference, which was held February 16th through the 18th and hosted by Marketplace Morning Report's David Brancaccio. The topic was India, Rising Ambitions, Challenges at Home. This program was pre-recorded for broadcast at this time, and it will be archived on our website, mainepublic.org. Click on radio to hear the program again at your convenience and to access many other past Speaking in Maine programs. The program will also be available as a podcast. On today's program, we'll hear two talks. We'll begin with Pratap Bhanu Mehta on India's post-colonial history. Following Dr. Mehta's talk, we'll hear from Ashutosh Varshney on India's politics and governance.
Our first speaker this morning, very excited. Pratap Bhanu Mehta is the Lawrence S. Rockefeller Professor for Distinguished Teaching at Princeton and President of the Center for Policy Research, New Delhi. Previously, he was a professor at NYU's School of Law, visiting professor of government at Harvard, associate professor of government and of social studies, also Harvard. Dr. Mehta was member convener of the Prime Minister of India's National Knowledge Commission and has contributed reports for leading Indian and international governmental agencies. He was at one time vice chancellor of Ashoka University. He resigned from that position in the winter of 2021 in an effort to protest political encroachments on academic freedom. His resignation led to university-wide protests demanding his reinstatement. He has published widely in political theory, the history of ideas, Indian constitutional law, and the politics of India. Dr. Mehta.
Thank you, David. It's a real honor and privilege to be here. And I must say, I've spoken at many venues. As academics, you tend to do that. But I've never seen a venue and an audience that is this special. Really, last night, new friendships, new conversations. So deeply grateful to the organizers of this wonderful institution called the Camden Conferences. So you all deserve a round of applause to begin with. I was given this wonderful task of talking about India's post-colonial history in about 25 minutes. And at one level, the task is very easy. I could have simply used the word cricket and said, our history used to be, we love this game of intractable rules with no result. Now this is a game we are beginning to dominate. The Indian Premier League is becoming the most valuable sports franchise in the world. And there is India rising and shining, post-colonial history done. But I'll resist the temptation, because when we talk about cricket, it takes even longer than talking about Indian history. So what I want to do today is perhaps politically de-exoticize India a bit. We've de-exoticized India in the realm of culture. It's no longer just the land of snake charmers. Although we should not forget that snake charmers were there. I mean, we shouldn't lose sight of that extraordinary sort of aesthetic and other forms of cultural diversity. But there is still a temptation to say that India is like the snake charmer version of politics. We don't really understand it. This is a weird country. And of course, at one level it is. It confounds our expectations. The usual categories of analysis sometimes don't apply to India. In political science, there always used to be this one footnote in every book on democracy. Well, India is an exception. We were not going to talk about it for 50 years, right? And I think it's particularly important to de-exoticize India and try and think of it in familiar terms, in terms of problems that all of us as democracies are facing, including many of the kind of citizens in this room. India is like America in many ways. It's large. It's important and self-important. It has an acute sense of the power of its own example, like the United States thinks of its own example as creating a kind of world revolution in the history of democracy. So does India, actually, in some ways, the world's largest democracy, the mother of all democracies. And like the United States, its modern history is a clash between two different exceptionalisms. On the one hand, like in the United States, there's a story about US exceptionalism, a country providentially endowed with liberty and the promise of liberation to mankind, yet also a country marked by racial hierarchy and violence. India, similarly, right? A country whose self-image, particularly in modern times, being driven by a sense of deep moral resources, perhaps an answer to the spiritual crisis of the world at the top of the Gangotri, right? And yet also a country marked by profound inequality and conflict. And we are at an interesting moment in Indian history because most countries, and at least large important ones, usually have to navigate both of these exceptionalisms simultaneously. As somebody once put it, they have to be both flag bearers of their image and their highest aspirations. And they also have to be cross bearers for the injustices of their society. But at this moment in 2024, there is, I have to confess, an almost Goebbelsian pressure in India to actually, in some senses, simply talk about and be a flag bearer of India's self-image. It's almost crowding out any serious analytical critical thinking about India. So how do we understand India at this moment? So let's begin with that self-image, because the self-image had a certain empowering quality to it. It was important. And like all self-images, it was founded on some truth and an aspiration that was entirely admirable. India was one of the few post-colonial societies that self-consciously chose the path of democracy, even as early as the 20th century, where there's no precedent, right, for democracy succeeding in a unlettered poor country. India chose that path, and it is remarkable how widespread that consensus was. India introduced universal suffrage at the lowest levels of income any country has, practically. And just to remind you, Switzerland had universal suffrage only as late as 1973. So in that sense, India is an astonishing country in the history of democracy, right? And India inverted the typical path of development. So the typical path of development was you kind of first build a nation, you reach a certain level of development, and then you, in a sense, politically liberalize and introduce democracy. India was this extraordinary experiment saying, we are going to do it, both nation building and development, through democratic political negotiations. Right? Absolutely, I mean, it is like 1776 was one moment in the history of democracy, 1947 was another. Certain truth to that. Part of what came with democracy in India, and again, India stands out in the pantheon of post-colonial countries, was a genuinely anti-revolutionary impulse in its politics. Now, this has a good side and a bad side. The bad side of that genuinely anti-revolutionary impulse in India's politics was that there was a kind of faith in slow ameliorative change. Particularly change that would affect India's deeply inegalitarian and underperforming economic structure, and its most astonishingly vile and oppressive social structure, namely in terms of caste. Right? But unlike many countries of the post-colonial South, you know, which had communist revolutions of various kinds, armed insurgencies, right? India self-consciously chose the path of an ameliorative response. And it says that the bad side is that sometimes it was a bit too compromising with this historical legacy of iniquity. But the plus side was that it generated a very self-conscious idiom, moral idiom about politics. Gandhi's insistence on nonviolence as being the central moral challenge for the 20th century, right? Even if you don't take it literally, even if you say, look, there may be circumstances, think of Nazi Germany, where such a council would be perhaps unsustainable or even foolish or perhaps even immoral. You could imagine those circumstances. But Gandhi's insistence that the means you deploy in politics will inevitably taint the ends you seek to pursue, right? And that there had to be a kind of moral and processual legitimacy to how you bring about social change became part of India's self-understanding about how politics ought to be conducted, right? And as I said, at one level, it gave India a unique moral voice, an extraordinary experiment. On the other hand, sometimes it has to be said, this idiom also facilitated a certain conservatism about India's social institutions and past, and we will hear a lot about that for the rest of this program, so I won't go into that. Right. In 1950, India also adopts a constitution, a remarkable constitution, one of the longest constitutions in the world. And for all its marginal compromises, this was a liberal constitution in its aspiration. Why do I say liberal constitution? Obviously, because it protected a whole series of liberal rights with some qualifications, free expression, freedom of association, freedom of trade, commerce, and so on and so forth, right? And I think the reason it's important to emphasize this choice, India did not always live up to protecting these rights. We know in certain parts of India, particularly Northeast, for a long time in Kashmir. But it is important to emphasize that it was a liberal constitution because there is a fashionable view going around that you can have something like illiberal democracy. Illiberal democracy is an oxymoron, and it's an oxymoron for two reasons. The constitutive rights that are central to liberal regimes, protection of individual dignity, freedom of expression, freedom of association, are also constitutive of democracy. And second, empirically, show me one regime that does not, if that regime assaults freedom of expression or freedom of association, it will not at some point try and subvert elections. So this bromide going around that somehow there's a kind of transitional moment, you either have liberal democracy or you don't. Okay. And this is one of the things I think we will be discussing in the rest, in I think Ashu's paper. But the second most remarkable thing to me about the Indian constitution and Indian exceptionalism was this wonderful little preamble to the Indian constitution, which just talks about the dignity of the individual and liberty, equality, and fraternity. It's one of the few preambles in the world that is not burdened with God, identity, or history. Even the Chinese Communist Constitution begins with 5,000 years history of Chinese civilization as a reference point. Now, why did the Indian framers do that? They did not do it because they did not think God was not important. God knows they knew God was important, right? And particularly in a country like India. But because they had the moral imagination to understand that if God was genuinely important, God could not be confined and bottled up into a political identity. They did not begin self-consciously, although there are references, they talk about India's traditional name, Bharat. They were all self-conscious of India's deep civilizational roots. But they also knew those civilizational roots were sites of contention. And if you wanted to build a forward-looking republic, you did not have to burden it with those controversies of history. People will argue about it. Some people will think India is a tale of oppression, conflict. Others will think this has been a magical history of 1,000 years. Get on with it, right? And they did not burden it, most importantly, with a singular benchmarked identity. They did not burden with it because identity, while it's important to us as individuals, identity often is the biggest threat to freedom, right? We should be free to make whatever identities we want, choose whatever path conduces to our self-development. But if you have a political establishment that benchmarks India is a country for Hindus, or India is a country for X, or this is what it means to be Indian, it will automatically produce exclusion and conflict. So it was a profoundly deep engagement with the history of global politics that led them to this conclusion and gave India a certain kind of lightness, a lightness of being in some ways, right? That God, history, and identity actually are things that come out of our freedom. They need not burden our freedom. Now, and part of the interest at this moment is that this is the project that is actually in jeopardy. And I'll just talk about it for a couple of minutes in a second. The last and final thing I just want to put on the table as part of a story of Indian exceptionalism, but perhaps failed Indian exceptionalism. One of the remarkable things about the Indian nationalist movement, not just Gandhi, this is Tagore, Aurobindo Ghosh, Jawaharlal Nehru, any significant leader of the Indian nationalist movement. They were all nationalists. They wanted self-determination for India. But they were deeply and acutely aware of what a crown of thorns the nation state is. They had looked at European history, and they came to what is a striking conclusion. Everywhere nation states have been formed, they have been formed through processes of violence, and most nation states have established their identity under the auspices of some kind of majoritarianism or dominant group, right? Later on, they liberalize something like that. Every empire, when it has dissolved, whether it's the Habsburg, the Ottoman, and those territories convert themselves into nation states, they produce conflict, homogenization, and ethnic cleansing. No exceptions to this. The history of nation states, I mean, and that's one of the tragedies of modernity, right? It's the institutional form in which we exercise our democratic rights, it protects our rights, but it is also the institutional form that has produced some of the most deepest and violent conflicts in the world. Acutely aware of this consciousness, they tried an experiment. Can we think of a nation state form, if you want to call it that, that has some of the advantages of a nation state, a modern state with great state capacity, yet does not fall into the trap of that European and North American history that nation states have fallen into? Now, I said it was a failed project because even by the 1930s, as the rifts between Hindus and Muslims grew over two particular issues, one, how is power going to be shared in this new democracy? And the conflict that emerged in the 1930s was a problem that came out of the process of democratization in some ways. That it's democracy that makes numbers important. Numbers make the question of majority versus minority important. How is power going to be shared? And emerging conflicts over how to represent the story of India's past. Because all nation states, in some senses, depend, or at least claim to depend, on these stories. So the nationalist movement, and Gandhi was very acutely conscious of this, by the 1930s and certainly by the 1940s, as this tension begins to grow, thinks of that extraordinary project that they were trying to create as something of a failure. India was born under the shadow of partition, right? and the horrendous violence that followed, 1 million to 2 million killed, depending on which data you believe. Yet, what remained very distinctive about India's, modern India's identity, again, very distinctive in the pantheon of post-colonial states, is this extraordinary aspiration to find a politics that was free of resentment. Okay. Again, going back not just to Gandhi, but every single Indian modern thinker thought that if the power of India's example has to mean anything, it must be the search for an alternative, more authentic, and more sincerely lived universality. As Arbindo Ghosh said, what would the point of independence be if we simply replaced colonial domination with some kind of collective narcissism and collective egoism, right? Even their engagement with the British was remarkably free of resentment. As Gandhi said, this is a common problem of civilization and modernity. Even colonialism, it's not the white man's problem. It is a problem of civilization and modernity that we have to, as a globe, as humanity, confront together. But the second and even more remarkable thing about this aspiration for a politics of resentment was a refusal to found a nation state on the politics of memory. There's a lot of talk these days about we have to look at India's history. As we know, what matters for nation states is not history but memory. History is about facts, right? In some ways, memory looks for facts that suit the objects of our recollection. Memory is about creating a community and identity, right? Memory is about taking facts from the past in a way in which you can take that identity forward. History is just about the past, right? One of the remarkable things about the Indian National Movement was it tried to refuse the politics of memory, because it's realized that any foundation of the nation based on a politics of memory would be a politics of resentment. Nietzsche very rightly said, if you want to be free of resentment, the one thing you don't need is actually memory. By that, it doesn't imply you don't remember particular moral wrongs or write particular morals, but the idea is not to create boundaries through that act of memory. One particular example, the ambassador referred to Swami Vivekanand. Swami Vivekanand visits Kashmir, and he's told about temples that have been destroyed by Muslim invaders. He's at this particular temple, Khir Bhavani. It's the temple to Goddess Kali and Shiva. It's a remarkable temple. And he starts weeping in the presence of the deity, saying, "Mother, how could you let this happen?" And he says, Mother came to him in a vision, Mother Kali, Goddess Kali, and said, "Son, is it my job to protect you or your job to protect me? Move on." Right? Remarkable fact, actually, about how you can actually overcome a cycle of recrimination, resentment, and memory. Now, at this particular historical juncture, in 2024, I think the simplest way of describing this moment is India is overturning almost every facet of this grand experiment. Right? It is an electoral democracy still, but as I said, you can't be a genuine democracy if there is no freedom of expression, if freedom of association is curtailed, if the information order is controlled, if independent institutions kowt out to the executive. Professor Vashni is probably going to touch on some of these stuff with more data than I can, right? And in part, this turning away is coming out of this sort of inchoate sense that somehow one of the things that has kept India backward is too much democracy. Right? India is the third largest country, is going to be the third largest economy in the world, but it is still below, it's what, 131 or something in the Human Development Index and per capita income. Right? And any sensible leadership, as I said, would be both the flag bearer of our image and our aspiration, but also be the cross bearer of, in a sense, the burden of that injustice. There was a book written by an American journalist, Catherine Mayo, in the 1930s called Mother India, which was like, you know, these days it reads like a cringe, scurrilous attack on India. I mean, just how awful India was, and, you know, sanitary conditions. And Gandhi's response to reading that book was, yes, this is a drain inspector's report, but every Indian should read it, right? Our current dispensation's response will be, if we can ban it, and even if we can ban those who read it, we'd be better off. So it's reneging on that promise of liberal democracy. But most profoundly, it is reneging on this extraordinary moral psychology that India's nationalist movement has bequeathed. When the Prime Minister inaugurated this temple at Ayodhya, which we talked about yesterday, he consistently says, this day is more important, or as important for India, as India's official Independence Day, August 15, 1947. Right? It is about taking a particular memory and taking it forward in a way which has no other objective but to marginalize India's plurality, marginalize India's Muslims. I mean, we can just go on and on about it. It's not just stopping at Ayodhya. Now there's a list of 4,000 monuments that the government and the ruling party wants to liberate. So in some ways, it is actually reneging on what was the most promising and grandest aspect of the modern Indian experiment. Now there's extraordinary things going on in India. India's economic dynamism is real. Unlike many critics of this government, I think its economic performance is not as great as it says, but it's not incompetent either. Mr. Modi is not Erdogan or Bolsonaro. Indian state capacity is expanding. India's technological prowess is expanding. So there is a kind of techno-modernism in which India will probably excel over the next decade or so. Great for the military-industrial complex in both our countries, right? It'll be extraordinary at that, no question about it. And yet you wonder whether this is also the moment, that's the real paradox we need to unravel. Why at this moment, it is also a country becoming full of resentful hearts, small minds, and constricted souls. Thank you.
Sorry, it took me a second to come out because I was writing down notes on that last amazing soundbite. Thank you. Let us now welcome to the stage Ashutosh Varshney, political scientist, is the Saul Goldman Professor of International Studies and Social Sciences, and a professor of political science at Brown University, where he directs the Saxena Center for Contemporary South Asia at the Watson Institute for International and Public Affairs. Dr. Varshney's research and teaching cover three areas: ethnicity and nationalism, political economy of development, and South Asian politics and political economy. His books include Battles Half Won, India's Improbable Democracy from 2013, and Ethnic Conflict and Civic Life, Hindus and Muslims in India. He's a contributing editor to the English language daily Indian Express. He served on the UN Millennium Task Force on Poverty and has been an advisor to the World Bank and the Club of Madrid. And I got to know him last night, amazing guy, Dr. Varshney.
Thank you, David, and thank you. Heartfelt thanks to the organizers of Camden Conference for bringing me here. It's just organizationally, this is a supreme effort. I direct a center, and putting together events of this kind is a very difficult task. So thank you all for organizing this, and thank you to the audience for coming. I will tell the story of constricted souls and small minds in an empirical way, which is what I do. Both of us agree a lot, Pratap and I. He comes to it through normative political theory and uses that to reflect on what's going on. And I'm an empirical political scientist, and I use normative political theory advisedly rather than as the basis for. So you'll see a roughly similar story presented differently. Here is the argument. India's democracy is recognized by theorists worldwide as historically exceptional, especially given its level of income. I'll say a little bit more about this. And Pratap was absolutely right. I mean, when India was born as a democracy, the literacy rate was 17%. 17%. There is no example in history where with 17% literacy, you had universal suffrage. But this claim applies mostly to India as an electoral democracy. India has functioned less well as a liberal democracy, and these gaps can be conceptualized as liberal deficits. India's recent record demonstrates that India's democratic evolution has reached a stage where the electoral and liberal aspects of democracy are now in a very, very deep conflict. India's electoral vibrancy, as you heard, continues, but the liberalism of its polity is seriously in decline. Elite choices based on values and ideologies and interests are central to understanding why India emerged and stabilized a democracy and why it's declining. And one way to summarize the argument is to say that India's electoral democracy today can undermine its constitutional democracy. Or India's electoral democracy can undermine the liberal promise of the Constitution. Elections can undermine the Constitution, to put it very simply. And elections are required by the Constitution, but they can be used to undermine the Constitution. That's the argument. Here are some key elements of modern democratic theory. I think we should begin with that rather than we should begin by putting India in the larger democratic theory perspective. Basically, we say in my discipline, political science, there are two requirements of democracy, a minimum requirement and some broader requirements. The minimum requirement is elections. No elections, no democracy. And a broader requirement is elections plus the conduct of the polity and especially the government between elections. What happens between elections, those 4 or 5 years? And there, the liberal freedoms about which you've just heard, or civil liberties, freedom of expression, freedom of religion, freedom of association are vital, central. And after 1945, this will play a role in the argument, after 1945, we add minority protections or minority rights to these civil liberties also, these three liberal freedoms. Expression, freedom of faith, and freedom of association. There is an income-based point in democratic theory, which is that democracies can be established at low levels of income, but they survive generally at high levels of income. The mortality rate of democracies is very high at low levels of income. And finally, another empirical argument that holds in global north. Who votes? The richer and the more educated the voter, the higher the odds of voting. It's a widely accepted empirical truth, if you will. Now, let's look at India's electoral vibrancy. Since 1952, 17 national elections. Power has changed hands 8 times in Delhi and tens of times at the state level. Political scientists don't count anymore how many times power changes hands at the state level. It's just a regular feature. In 1952, 81 million votes were cast. In 2019, nearly 610 million votes were cast. And it probably will be 700 in May, in April and May, in the next few months. Turnouts now routinely in excess of 60%, which America, incidentally, hasn't reached in the 20th century, 60% and above. Obama election came up to about 58, which was very high for America. Mr. Trump has claimed that 2019 was higher than ever. I don't think that's true. The last two elections, 2014 and 2019, had record turnouts over 65%. Narendra Modi has won 2 most participatory elections of Indian history when the turnout was in excess of 65%. Until 1989, following mainstream democratic theory, the richer and more educated citizens used to vote more than the poorer and the less educated. Since 1989, defying democratic theory, the poor and the less educated have voted as much as, if not more, than their more fortunate co-citizens. A plebeian turn in India's democratic evolution arrived over the last 40 years, last 30 years, last 30 years. And here is the comparison. This is the Indian line. The higher you are, the better your performance over time. This is the North American, Western European line. India has been basically, over its history, below only the North American and West European line, even though its income is a fraction of the income of North America and Western Europe, right? And of late, you can see the decline. This, after 2014, you can see the decline. Other lines are not very relevant here. There's an all-world line, there is an Asia line. But basically, the more important point here is that Indian democratic performance here is only, except in the first few years when it is higher than the North American line, blacks got the right to vote basically in 1965 after losing the right to vote in the American South for under Jim Crow. So Robert Dahl, the great democratic theorist, says that Indian democracy between 1950 and 1965 was ahead of American democracy. Because blacks got their vote back after the 15th Constitutional Amendment of 1870, only in 1965 in the South. Okay, so that's the summary of the electoral vibrancy. Now, on income, maybe a minute on that. The most remarkable data set is produced by a very distinguished senior political scientist, now retired, Adam Shaworsky of NYU. The data set covered 141 countries between 1950 and 1990, and statistically, he could show that income predicted 77.5% of the cases. No other predictor of democratic longevity was as good as income. Ethnic diversity, international political environment, colonial legacy, religion. So income didn't predict everything, but predicted 77.5% of variation, right? India is in the latter 22.5%, 22.5% set, and there's only the following countries in that. India, Mauritius, Belize, Jamaica, Papua New Guinea, Solomon Islands, and Vanuatu, which is probably 123,000 people or so, right? And then he concludes, the most surprising case is India, to quote this, the biggest empirical project undertaken in democracy and relationship between democracy and development, the odds against democracy in India were extremely high. And it adds that Singapore is the exception on the other side. No non-oil No non-oil high-income country is undemocratic except Singapore. Singapore's per capita income is today $2,000 higher than the United States. It is richer than the United States, according to the IMF and the World Bank, per capita income. But it's undemocratic. Okay, now from elections to the idea of liberal deficits, or from electoral to liberal democracy. As you heard, standard in liberal freedoms common to virtually all varieties of at least post-1945 liberalism is freedom of expression, freedom of religious practice, freedom of association, and minority rights. Why are these important? Once the minimum criteria of contestation and participation, which is electoral, are satisfied, a democracy can attain higher quality, meaning it can become deeper if liberal freedoms between elections are available, if citizens are free to speak, free to associate, free to practice their faith. So we cannot have a democracy without free elections, but a democracy would be deeper if non-electoral dimensions of freedom, not simply free vote, were also available. Now, Pratap made a very important point. If you start attacking liberal freedoms, freedom of association, freedom of expression, freedom of religious faith, then will elections also not be attacked at some point? This is an important question, and it'll be tested soon. But in principle, you can separate the two. In principle, you can separate. Well, practically, this will be the attack on liberal freedoms will be extended to electoral freedoms, or the electoral, the sanctity of the electoral process will be tested. Okay, here is a special case of minority rights. This is appeared in liberal theory after 1945 very prominently, and we can understand why. All post-1945 democracies are not only based on the idea of power stemming from electoral majorities, which will define whoever wins the election runs the government, has power, but also on minority protections, now a requirement. Majorities can protect themselves by their numerical weight. Minorities don't have the numbers. Hence, minority rights always constitutionally protected in modern democracies. Without minority protections, democracy can become a brute majoritarian force. Example, Nazi Germany and Jim Crow American South. Carl Schmitt, a German legal theorist who ended up joining the Nazis, drew a distinction between democracy and liberalism. Democracy was about expression of majority wishes. Liberalism meant for him protection of individual freedoms and minority rights. Jews in Germany, he argued, could be protected under liberalism, but not under democracy. If majority of Germans wanted Jews restricted, expelled, or even killed, that's a democratic wish. Please note, and he ended up, one of the greatest legal political and legal theorists of the 1920s ended up joining the Nazis on this ground. And he didn't think liberalism was the way to rebuild Germany. Democracy was the way to rebuild Germany. This distinction, therefore, was given up after the anti-Jewish horrors of Europe in the 1930s and 40s. All post-1945 democracies now tend to have rights for religious, racial, ethnic minorities built into their political fabric. You draw this distinction, you create very serious problems, as Pratap just pointed out. Very serious problems once you draw this distinction between liberalism and it can be done. But practically, this means a lot of violence, disaster, horrors. Liberal freedoms in India. India is freest at the time of elections. Short of inciting violence, virtually any argument can be made in election campaigns. Mr. Rahul Gandhi in 2019 campaigned on the Prime Minister is a thief slogan. Chaukidar chor hai. Prime Minister is a thief. That was a slogan on which he campaigned. So it's freest at the time of elections, and we'll see whether it remains true in April and May, coming April and May. But once an elected government takes over, restrictions on basic liberties are often placed. Intellectuals, writers, artists, journalists, professors, students, NGOs can face harassment on grounds that they hurt sentiments of certain groups or undermine national interest. These problems are common to all kinds of government. Examples: Rushdie's Satanic Verses was first banned in India under Congress rule because of Muslim right. And also under Congress party, M.F. Hussain had to migrate to, had to leave India, famous painter, because of Hindu right. Muslim right made Satanic Verses virtually impossible, and Hindu right made M.F. Hussain's paintings or his continuance virtually impossible. But these problems become especially serious when Hindu nationalists come to power, as is true since 2014. Why? Minorities automatically get added to the list of targets, not simply writers or artists. A Hindu-centric view of the nation leads to that. India, for Hindu nationalists, is primarily a Hindu nation, which is a fundamentally, as you heard, unconstitutional idea. Much like the idea that America is a white nation. While that's been politically believed in, you know, in American history in many parts, that's not a constitutional idea. Now, the most important target, the most important target of Hindu nationalists historically and today is the Muslim minority of India. Every Hindu nationalist text starting from 1925 makes that case. Riots used to be the principal form of communal violence. Riots have declined since the mid-1990s. Since 2014, however, a relatively new form of communal violence has emerged, lynching. Another familiar thing from Jim Crow South. Muslims are its main victims. Here is data. So this is number of deaths. This is the frequency of lynchings this year. After 2014, you can see the rise in lynchings. And who are the principal victims? After 2014, this line is the Muslim victims. This line is the Hindu victim. This line is Christian victims. So it's not that only Muslims are targeted. That's not the case that this data makes. This data makes the case that Muslims are targeted much, much more, many times more than Hindus and Christians in lynchings, and of course they are only 14 to 15% of India. And Christians are 2% of India, and Hindus are roughly 80% of India. So this distribution is very different from demographic distribution. That establishes the case for targets. The population that is 14 to 15% of India is lynched many times more. The ostensible aim of lynchings is to prevent the eating of beef and production of and selling of cow meat. Premised on the claim that cows are sacred to many Hindus, beef eating, though beef is eaten by Hindus in eastern southern India. To prevent Hindu conversion to Islam, premised on the claim that such conversion is always promoted by coercion, deceit, or material temptation. To prevent young Muslim men from marrying Hindu women, not to prevent Hindu men from marrying Muslim women, but prevent young Muslim men from marrying Hindu women, premised on the claim that these are aimed at increasing the size of Muslim population, which if not stopped now would eventually overwhelm the Hindu population. Statistically impossible. 14% cannot become 51% in the matter of 3, 4, 5, 6, 7 decades. Even 100 years would not be able to do that. But the statistics doesn't matter in this claim. 14% will become, through the method of marrying Hindu women, 14% will become 54%. Hard not to infer that the fundamental aim of lynchings is establishment of Hindu primacy and reduction of Muslims to the status of secondary citizens. Now, some of us are involved in reconstructing empirical democratic theory and emphasizing on elite choices, elite behavior, and elite ideologies, as opposed to income level, as opposed to inequality, as opposed to ethnic diversity, as opposed to some other structural characteristic. We really want elite behavior, political parties, back at the center of democratic analysis. Not these some structural conditions, objective conditions. And if we go do that, which some of us have started doing, and the first edited volume is already out on that, and much more work is being done, the focus on elites then can be divided into three parts: the founding moment and the formative period of Indian democracy, the period since the only nationwide breakdown, 75-77 until 2014, and the period since 2014. In the first period, elite values played a big role in institutionalizing democracy. I've gone through the Constituent Assembly debates. On universal suffrage, I found only 7 people arguing with some trepidation and with some, no one is arguing against democracy. On universal suffrage, only 7 objections were raised in an assembly of 299, I think, constituent assembly, and they were dropped. There was widespread agreement among the elites of India that there should be universal suffrage, despite 17% literacy rate, despite one of the lowest incomes in the world, per capita incomes in the world, and democracy will be central to everything Indian polity does, everything Indian economy does. Democracy will not be suspended for reasons of economic development. Democracy will not be suspended if wars take place, etc., etc. In the second period, I argue, this is not important here, values explain a lot, but serious interests also developed in the continuance of democracy. Here is the most important part. While dealing with the recent decline in liberal aspects of democracy, the most important thing to note is that Hindu nationalism is the guiding ideology of those in power in Delhi and in half of India's states, not all of India's states. That ideology says that India is a Hindu nation. And then I'm using my words very carefully, a truth that the Constitution and post-independence polity wrongly and unjustly denied. Hindu nationalists did not accept India's Constitution to begin with. Did not. Further, according to this ideology, Muslims cannot be equal to Hindus. Hindus are the original owners of India as a nation, and Muslims have been disloyal to India. Indeed, the Delhi Sultanate, 1206 to 1526, and Mughal Empire, 1526-17, were equal to colonialism. Colonialism did not begin with the British occupation of India. This is a very remarkable historical claim. No professional historian ever agreed with this claim. They all argued the colonialism began with British occupation of India. Hindu nationalists say colonialism began at least in 1206 when Delhi Sultanate, which was Muslim rule, was established, and possibly since 711 when Sindh, now part of Pakistan, at that point part of India, was first conquered by the general of Umayyad Caliphate. At the deepest philosophical level, the idea is that rights should not be given on an individual basis, which is how rights are conceptualized in a modern democracy. Rather, rights should be assigned on a community basis, communities that have historically contributed more to India or communities that have been more loyal to India should have superior bundle of rights. What is equal rights? That doesn't make sense according to them. How can Muslims and Hindus be equal in India? They can be, you know, Muslims can have whatever rights they have in the Middle East, but not, they cannot be equal to Hindus in India. Even in principle, let alone in practice, the notion violates the idea of citizen equality without which modern democracy cannot function. The biggest move towards Hindu supremacy, as Pratap has already mentioned, was made on January 22nd this year in the temple consecration in Ayodhya. It was court approved. I don't think the court approved that the Prime Minister should be consecrating. Court simply said the temple should be built. They did say that. The court approved the building and consecration of the Ram Temple in Ayodhya as the biggest symbolic and discursive move towards Hindu supremacy in post-47 India. Why? Violating a core commitment of India's constitution, namely religious neutrality. India's Prime Minister, along with 2 other constitutional authorities, consecrated the Hindu temple in a huge state-sponsored occasion. The chief of the RSS, the mother organization of Hindu nationalism, was seated next to the Prime Minister. The founding institution of Hindu nationalism, Rashtriya Swayamsevak Sangh, its chief was seated next to India's highest constitutional or second highest constitutional authority, the Prime Minister of India. The rhetoric of PM Modi's speech openly displayed the new ideology. And I'll say something in Hindi, those who know Hindi. Ram se Rajya aur Niti tak, which essentially means Ram, Lord Ram, Hindu Lord Ram as the basis of statecraft. Niti aur Ram se Rajya tak, Ram se Niti tak. Then another thing that we've been discussing in our group, Ram se Rashtri Chetna ka Vikas, Lord Ram, Hindu Lord Ram, as a medium for the spread of national consciousness. The freedom movement had a different concept of national consciousness. That freedom movement and its concept of national consciousness and national identity anchored in the Constitution of India is to be changed, to be altered fundamentally. If Modi wins again in May 2024, the most important question will be what laws will be brought in through Parliament to give the idea of Hindu supremacy legal foundations. Discursively, it's happening. Symbolically, it's happening. What laws will be brought in? Some have been brought in already. They've not been implemented yet, but what laws will be brought in? Will India, or at least the BJP-dominated states, that's half of India, have a Jim Crow-style legal order? Not, of course, for white supremacy, but for Hindu supremacy, all ostensibly electorally legitimated. That is the very big paradox here. Electoral democracy now has the potential for undermining the constitutional order. India's electoral democracy and constitutional democracy are now fundamentally at odds. So I think I'm done. My time is up. My time is up. You've heard an account here from both of us, which is roughly the same. Presented differently is roughly the same account. Thank you.
You've been listening to Speaking in Maine on Maine Public Radio. Today's program featured talks by Pratap Banu Mehta and Ashutosh Varshney at the 2024 Camden Conference. For more information on the 2024 Camden Conference, including suggested reading, please visit camdenconference.org. If you missed part of the program or want to listen again, you can also find it on our website, mainpublic.org. Click on radio to access this program and many of our archived Speaking in Maine programs. Music in this hour comes from Our Alarm Clock. Susan Tran is the executive producer of Speaking in Maine, and Speaking in Maine is produced by me, Sam Tracy. Thanks for joining us. This is Maine Public Radio.